Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Hey, it's Elton Jim Toronto, and this is Captain Podtastic. And welcome to another episode of Elton Jim Toronto's Captain Podtastic. Right here at WGNplus.com. Every Monday, new episode is posted up for your listening and binging pleasure. And please don't forget to go to my landing page at WGNplus.com in the entertainment section, where you can find all previous 104 episodes of this very podcast, because this is episode 105. I'm very excited today because today's podcast will be featuring a member of the Elton John band. I don't overdo a lot of Elton John stuff, even though this podcast is named somewhat after him. Captain Podtastic is a takeoff on Captain Fantastic, which is one of his best albums, and the first album ever in the history of music to enter the Billboard charts at number one. But anyway, so today we'll be talking with the percussionist in Elton John's band, John Mahon. And it goes both ways, and you'll hear that in the interview. But John is been a percussionist in Elton's band for over 20 years now. And so we will talk about his career, what it's like working with a legend, and certainly what it's going to be what he's going to be doing to prepare for the upcoming farewell tour later in this year of 2018, when Elton has announced that he will be leaving the road forever in terms of giant tours. He will still continue to perform, he'll still continue to record, but he's not going to be doing the big major tours, traveling all around the world for months at a time, because he wants to spend time with his children. He's 71 years old, his kids are 7 and 5, and so he wants to spend as much time as possible with them, and how can you complain about that? But John Mahon has some really interesting, fun stories to talk about what it's like being on stage in front of 20,000 people a night when you look over to the side and you see a legend who is your boss and your friend after 20 years. So sit back. Even if you're not an Elton John fan, I think you'll get some really interesting information about what it's like being on the road and being around in a rock band and as I said, playing with someone of Elton John's status. Interesting guy, fun guy, really good guy, John Mahon. Well, first I want to welcome my guest here, but I want to ask him if he is introduced here on this podcast the same way that he's introduced on stage for Elton John. Is it Mahon or Mahon? Let's start that out first.
Well, that's one of the greatest questions of all time. it's an Irish name, obviously. My father, at one point, I heard the name used to be pronounced Man or Mahon is the true Irish pronunciation of it, and then In Britain they say Mahon.
Right.
In Spain they say Mahone.
Oh, really?
Of course, in Eastern America, a lot of people said Mahan, which is or Mahon. So there's like so many pronunciations, and I guess the story is my grandmother used to tell my father his name was Mahon, the real Irish name, and then he was a cop, and when he got on the job, I guess the guy said, "That's too hard to say. It's Mahon."
So when someone shakes your hand and says hi,
yeah,
you say Mahon.
Yeah, it's pretty much John Mahon.
Oh, okay, because I always heard Mahon.
Well, Elton, when he first met me, he, you know, started saying John Mahon. Sometimes he calls me that, like, you know, it's almost like his little bouncy way of, you know, of screwing around, you know, hey, here comes John Mahon. You know, they all say it. And, you know, but honestly, it's from my family way. We say it Mahon, most of the people in my family. And I don't have a problem with John Mahon because, a lot. I have some other friends, and their last name is Mahan, and it's Mahan with them.
Oh, all right.
So it's, yeah.
Because I always thought that may have been an onstage little dig or joke, because if anybody goes to an Elton John concert with any kind of regularity, and I've been known to, you know, he'll sometimes not even introduce you by name.
Exactly.
But he'll make up some ridiculous crazy name that either is an inside joke. You guys always seem to laugh. Davey falls over with laughter every time one of the fake name comes out. So I thought maybe he was doing some kind of Mahan just to give you a little joke. But then
he's asked me about it. You know.
Oh, okay. Well, that's cool.
And he's met some members of my family, and you know, and he's like, really? That's how you guys say it? I says, you know, it just kind of goes back from that's what my parents told us. You know, so. Believe me, it flops back and forth, and I don't have a problem with it. But it is fun when he gives us a fake name.
Oh, you do like that?
Oh, we kind of dig it. Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
I mean, I don't necessarily like it if I'm playing in my hometown.
Right. Exactly. Right.
Know?
Yeah.
You know?
It'd be nice. You know. For a little, for the effort, you know, to get a little.
Well, he usually winds you up backstage and says, "Oh, you're getting a name tonight." You know.
Oh, really?
If you're in a place you really don't want one, he'll come over before the one and go, "Oh, I'm going to make you." One time, I think he announced me as, you know, the I had just come out of the closet. He said, "John, let's congratulate John tonight. Just come out of the closet." And, you know, the biggest poof in California.
Oh, how funny. Well, like I said, I could always see the dynamic when he gives. Sometimes he does it straight and gives the legit names, and sometimes he starts with the first one, and then everybody's kind of bracing for what name, because if anybody who knows Elton John, when he checks into a hotel, the names can get not only crazy but very sexually suggestive.
Yeah. He pretty much does it with, you know, he doesn't screw with Navy and Nigel too much, because I think he thinks maybe they don't like it, even though I think they kind of do. But, you know, he really lets Matt and I have it, and Kim, you know, he lets us have it. But sometimes we have to, lately we've had to, like, ask him, come on, give me a name.
You know? Really?
Yelling on stage just to wind him up.
Oh, that's too funny. Well, then let me start officially the interview by introducing Mr. John Mahan.
There you go, man.
There you go. Of the Elton John Band, and the percussionist, drummer, harmony singer, backing vocal, you name it. Jack of all trades and master of most of them as well.
I hope so.
And always fun to sit at a concert and listen to you. Play anything, including the kitchen sink. Sometimes it seems you're always hitting something. There's
absolutely
very few moments when you're not. And John has been a member of the Elton John Band now, and kudos to this, for over 20 years. In fact, 2017 was your 20th anniversary, so you're getting close to almost 21 years consecutively, and that's quite an achievement. Because even though other band members like Davey and Nigel, Davey Johnstone, the music director, and Nigel Olsen, the longtime drummer that goes back with Elton to his first album, Empty Sky, in the late 60s, 1969, but many of them, especially Nigel, did not have a continual kind of tenure. So, wow, what an amazing run that you have had.
I know, it's been amazing. I haven't got fired.
Well, you know, that was one of the first questions I wanted to ask, because you know, you came on in a time when in the late 90s, and the band had been shifting a lot. There were background vocalists that came and went, and there were some other you know, in the early 90s there were other guitar players, some, you know, added people. So there was a little fluidity to the band for a while. John Jorgensen came in. There were some other people in the early 90s. And so you came on, and you actually came on after Ray Cooper had been in the band for a while.
Right, right.
And those are pretty big shoes to fill, because Ray Cooper, as Elton says in concert, has played with almost everyone of note or notoriety in rock music over the last 40 years.
Exactly. And
so was there a time when you were when you first got the job? And we'll talk in. I want to certainly it's an interesting story. But how long was it? It's been 20 years now. But how long was it when you felt like you got the gig?
It's been about 2 years.
Oh, so it hasn't been too stressful, which is nice.
Yeah. You know, when you're a musician like I am, you know, a working musician, you know, that's really what I consider myself, is just a working musician. I don't really consider myself a pop star or, you know, or one of these guys that were, you know, like Davey and Nigel were kind of in the original,
right,
you know, Yellow Brick Road days where they all were, you know, they were kind of rock stars, you know. I mean, they were rock stars. And I always consider myself like Bob Birch, you know, and Guy. We were just working musicians. And you kind of look at pretty much like any day now, Elton could just say, well, you know, I'm going to switch the band up, or I want some new faces. Or I think I'm still here, you know, like some of the other singers went and the guitar player, because Elton was always trying to find that real concise band, you know, a really tight little, he never wanted a big band, you know. Once in a while he gets talked into, you know, adding this or adding that. And, you know, like, let's say, for example, the four girl background singers, they came about because they did those records with T-Bone, and
right,
and you know, and they added a real sound. Then Elton wanted that sound for a period of time, and then he's like, you know what, I'm getting back to the, you know, I'm getting back to the core band, and I think I've survived because, you know, I kind of provide a little extra thing that not many other people, you know, can do, because I can cover the vocals and I can do electronic stuff if I have to, and sampling and sounds, and I can play some, you know, keyboard marimba parts, and, you know, obviously the percussion and the drum stuff. But I guess what I bring to the band is, well, it's basically what he likes. You know, it's like he, you don't push it too far, and you don't, he wants you to be exciting. He wants you to, you know, to really step out and inspire him.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to inspire Elton John is not easy.
Well, that's the one thing. Yeah, I mean, that's the one thing that, you know, especially, you know, the set list for the most part is a fairly good representation of the entire catalog. But at times, certainly, you know, does favor the early 70s, which makes sense, especially with people at this point coming, you know, sure, maybe sometimes for the first time and wanting to see those songs. And so, and when you listen to the early songs, that albums that were produced by Gus Dudgeon, they were very layered. There was a lot of different sounds. And so certainly somebody that is able to recreate, and I've noticed over the last 5 or 6 years, a lot of the versions that you play now on stage are reverting back more to the original, to sound more.
Exactly.
Like the original, especially Benny and the Jets. I don't know if that's you playing the little organ in the end or if that's Kim Ballard.
That's probably Kim playing.
Yeah, but, you know, there is that, at the end of Benny and the Jets on the recorded version, there's a little organ playing, and that had always been lost in the live rendition. And now over the last couple of years, I heard that come back, and it's very cool just to hear those little touches. And that's really what you do provide are, for people who are listening close and remember a lot of the original recordings.
Yeah,
that's what really, why I listen so much for what you do, is because it's like, he did it. Very good.
And kudos to, you know, that's where it goes back to, you mentioned Ray. You know, when I got in the band, I went in there and, you know, when I knew that I was getting in the band or was auditioning for the band, and, well, that's two funny stories I'll tell you about that. You know, you're talking about when I feel comfortable in the band. So when I was getting the gig and trying to, you know, become a true member, I would really study what Ray did, you know. You know, Elton and Ray parted ways for who knows what reason, you know, back in the 90s somewhere after they did their two-man tour. And I think, you know, Elton wanted a break from that. And I'm not sure why Ray didn't come back. It was personal stuff. I'm not really sure. But anyways, I just studied as much of what Ray did as possible and tried to emulate what he did, but bring my own little, you know, I didn't want to do exactly what he did, but I didn't ever want to let out a part that he did go by, right? I like say the castanets in Funeral for a Friend.
Well, you know, I can't believe it. I was just going to mention that.
Yeah.
I was
just such huge parts.
That is, it's a small little touch, but if you know that song, you want to hear that click, click, and you want to hear that the way it's, you know, it's not on every beat.
Right, right.
And
kudos to Clive Franks, because he was the one that talked me into actually, I don't actually play the real castanets. I have a sampled sound of the, I mean, I have a recorded sound of the castanet that I actually play the part, but every time I hit the pad, it's one click of a castanet, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So I still play the part, but Clive wanted me, he had such trouble, because we're such a loud band, he really wanted to hear that castanet part, because it's so great.
Yeah.
And he's going, man, you know, all I can hear is you're just getting buried up there with all the, you know, you got Davey next to me and Elton's loud. So I sampled the part, and Clive was like, oh, that's great. I can turn it up as loud as I want and put it right where he wants it in the mix. So that's one of those Ray Cooper things, you know, that I always said I have to do that, because Ray just came up with the most incredible. I mean, if you talk about rock and roll back in the day, there weren't many guys putting a percussion player in their band and really featuring them. You know, maybe a conga player you'd hear in the Doobie Brothers or something.
Right, right.
Ray came up with more orchestral. Ray is really an orchestral player. You know, he's not like, let's say, a R&B type of or a Latin player, you know. He is an orchestral player, and that's why I think his brain went to some of those really interesting parts, like the rototoms and the, you know, the tambourine, the tambourine rolls. Those are orchestral musical parts. But
and as John is saying, for people that are not acquainted with Ray Cooper, you are, whether you know it or not, because you have heard his percussion, and even for the most casual fan, if you recall the Eric Clapton video for the Unplugged Layla.
Wow.
That's Ray Cooper.
That's Ray Cooper,
when you hear that, and you'll see him in that video. I'm just trying to give a reference point for people, but as you said, Ray is a character unto himself. He's in most of the, somewhere, he's in most of the Monty Python movies. He has really played, and it's not even exaggeration, with most people, and of note, you know, throughout the last 40 years. And like you said, I think what he's provided for you, when he doesn't add when he's not with the band, because sometimes he is with this current touring band and sometimes he isn't. And so what he certainly has provided for you is a very large palette to play on. It's not just a lot of times, and I'm not saying this in any kind of a throw off way, percussionists in a lot of bands are almost just like an added thing. If we're going to have a big band, well, let's just throw a percussion in this, and it looks and it does, you know, from a performing standpoint, you know, it is very impressive up there. You've got, as I said, all those different things, the congas and this and that, so it's kind of a cool thing to just watch. Mm-hmm. But you are,
you never hear a percussion player when you go to a concert.
No,
that's one of my huge pet peeves. I go to a concert, I go, turn off the percussion.
Yeah,
player. God, man.
But no, you can hear you, and like even to the smallest little rustle. You know, when you what do you call that when you take your hands and you go across those little chimes, like those wind chimes?
Oh, that's actually called a mark tree.
A mark tree. Oh, okay.
A mark tree, yeah. I'm not sure where that name comes from, but, you know, wind chimes are the kind that hang straight down in a cluster.
Yeah.
And some people call those cluster chimes or cluster bells, but the one that's all different lengths, that's called a mark tree.
Huh.
And I think it might be originally an Asian invention. But
because that could easily get lost in a concert.
Yeah.
Sound, and yet every time you or Ray does that in a song, it really is. And so kudos once again. And you mentioned Clive. That's Clive Franks, who used to be Elton's sound engineer. Hasn't worked with him for many years now, but certainly
retired.
Yeah, but certainly the sound and many of the things that Clive I think instituted still remain in terms of the mix in a live.
Yeah, that really is Clive that pushed. You know, went on to his assistant became his mentor. Matt uh-huh. and Matt pretty much, you know, took the Clive way of tuning the PA system, and You know, Clive had a very special way of making the band.
Oh,
most bands you go hear nowadays, it's really hard to hear, like, the bass guitar, or it's hard to hear a real true kick drum sound. And, man, Clive is a master at bringing that, because Clive played bass.
Right.
He was a master of bringing that bass sound out so you could actually go, I can hear the bass. It just doesn't sound like a rumble.
Oh, yeah. No, no. The bass, whether it was Bob Birch's bass, former bassist for Elton John band for many years, and now Matt Bassinet. And even if you listen to the live performances of the great Dee Murray, you know, that the bass was always prominent. And certainly on record, you know, Gus Dudgeon in the early 70s really almost made... the bass a lead instrument at times. I mean, that the bass on Rocket Man alone, you know, is impactful. The first, you know, as the song starts. I must say one thing before we leave Ray Cooper. My joke about Ray Cooper is he is what is most impressive with him is he can make hitting one beat on a tambourine look and feel as if he is climbing Mount Everest.
I know, it's incredible, isn't it?
He is really a showman in every sense of the word. And
I know, it's just amazing.
Yeah, to watch him hit one beat, it's almost a show unto itself, and it really is.
It looks incredibly exciting. It looks painful.
Oh, I know. Like, oh my goodness! He's great to watch, and I'm going to talk about the Vegas shows, and he really does get a chance to shine there. And I remember seeing many of the Elton and Ray Cooper combination tours starting back from 1979. Through they did many in the 90s as well, but I wanted to talk to you as well because you know, even though this band has gone through a lot of transition, you know, you are a Midwestern boy from Ohio,
Canton.
And Canton, Ohio, home of the Football Hall of Fame.
You got it.
And but as I read your background, you know, It's really you made a gutsy move in the mid 80s. What, 1983? How old were you?
27.
27 years old, and
something like that.
Yeah, and so, and you just packed up. You had a wife, and you basically, on the advice of a friend who had been out in L.A. for a while, you kind of packed up the bags, and it's almost like a romantic comedy movie.
Yeah,
where you just packed up a car and just went west, young man.
Beverly Hillbillies, man. I mean, that's kind of what we did. You know? We just got married, and then and my drum teacher at the time he had moved out to L.A. like 2 years before, and he kept calling me, bugging me. You know, we'd talk, and man, you gotta get out of there, man. Come on, you gotta come out here to L.A. And then one day I just said, do you want to go to L.A.? And she's like, yeah, let's go. So we just basically saw.
Well, and kudos to her. Thankfully, because that could have been a weird situation if she would said, no, look, I assume she has family there. Another person may have said, no, no. I mean, you know, this is fine, but, you know, this little music thing you want to do is interesting, but I'm not uprooting myself. But for her to just sort of go and be as adventurous and to support you is really an amazing thing, too.
Yeah. We had gone to California a few years before that, took a little trip with some friends, you know, and got our first taste of California. And, you know, when you grow up in Ohio and you get out there and you're standing in Malibu looking at the ocean, you go, this is pretty good.
Oh, yeah, there's no question about that. But it's still,
I mean. So we both just, you know, we had been there, so we both were like, let's go, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's.
And you've had and certainly, I mean, you went out there. It sounds as if, like any working musician, as you said, and you described yourself earlier.
Yeah.
It's nice to be a working musician with a regular paycheck, though, I'm sure.
Oh, it's unbelievable. You know, when I moved to California, you just reminded me, we sold everything that we owned. We kept a couple little pieces of furniture, some personal stuff, and I kept, you know, one drum set. And we basically had a little Toyota pickup truck with no air conditioning, rented a U-Haul trailer, filled the trailer up and tied some of the other stuff on top of the pickup truck, and then basically just drove across the country. And we knew two people. We knew my drum teacher who lived in L.A., and then I had a cousin that lived like out in San Bernardino, so like, you know, 100-some miles outside of the city. And we went to his house first because he gave us a place to stay, but we didn't have any place to live. We saved $5,000 between the two of us, and that's what we went out there with.
Wow.
And no work, and my wife wound up getting a job at the company that she used to work with, which was the Hoover Sweeper Company, North Canton, Ohio.
Oh, there you go.
They gave her a little part-time job, so at least we had a little money coming in. And and my friend Bill, he recommended me for a couple of what we call casuals, you know, where you just eat like a wedding reception or a private party, and you just show up and you know, you show up and there's already a bunch of musicians you've never met before, and the guy goes, number 43 in the book. And
oh, there you go.
Book open, it could be anything from, you know, a Madonna song to New York, New York or whatever.
Right, right. And you have
remember saying that they were some of the greatest when I played, like, the first band. The first time I played, I sat there and I went, these musicians are almost better than anyone I've ever played with, and we're doing a wedding reception.
Right.
You know, and that was a real wake up call. Like, you better get your butt in gear.
Yeah. Well, because when you think about it, everybody that's in LA for the most part did exactly what you did.
Yep, they did. Exactly.
You know, anybody who had a dream and had the ability and the talent, they went out to L.A. I mean, especially from the music business. Even, you know, being here in Chicago, Chicago has certainly been, you know, the birthplace for a lot of bands that have broken huge, obviously, the group Chicago.
Yeah, right.
But the fact of the matter is, and being a fan of the music scene here, it's not so much today because the music business has changed, but, you know, back in the 60s and 70s and even into the 80s, you could have a very good reputation here in Chicago and do well and make a little noise, but if you wanted to go to that next level, if you wanted to take that next step, you had to go to L.A.
Yeah, or New York.
Or New York, certainly, yeah. But you couldn't do it, even though Chicago is a major city and has a major musical history. That's where the business was. And so, like, to your point, you know, when you go to L.A., it's the major leagues, and even the worst guy is the best guy on his high school team, you know?
Yeah, I mean, the only reason New York was in the works, and Nashville was discussed, but we only knew one. We didn't know anyone there.
Right.
We knew this one guy in L.A., and we just went, let's go to L.A.
And you've had a chance, and while you were there, you did a lot of session work then as your career progressed, and you've worked with some nice names, Al Stewart and Helen Reddy, and mm-hmm. some other. In fact, I just saw Al Stewart a couple last summer. He's touring, playing Year of the Cat album in its entirety.
Oh, my God. Wow.
Yeah. It was really,
I did a little short stint with him. And, you know, I tried to just get my feet in there, and I just had my own original band. And then on the side, I played clubs and gigs. And then, of course, I started playing with some of these smooth jazz artists like Peter White. And Peter introduced me to Al Stewart. And I was in another band called Windows that did pretty well. That was one of the first, you know, one of the early smooth jazz bands.
Mm-hmm. Which was a bit, which of course in the late 80s and early 90s, the whole smooth jazz movement was sort of happening, and there was a lot of radio stations that were playing that, and you sort of hit, that was, you know, kind of the Grover Washington kind of sound and things like that. So let's fast forward then. Here's John and his wife. They go out to L.A. He finds a little niche. He's surviving and building his way up, and I guess what you call a fortunate meeting with, as we mentioned before, bassist Bob Birch, who was also out there in Los Angeles and a studio guy, and then he hooks up with Davey Johnstone, and who is the longtime guitarist and musical director for Elton John, becomes a member of Elton's band, and I guess he then was the conduit to introducing you to Davey. Is that the way it happened?
Yes. I mean, Bob and I moved to L.A. almost the same time. He moved from Detroit.
He was Detroit, yeah. Bob used to always wear Detroit Red Wings hockey jerseys, and I had a chance to meet him several times, and I'm a big Blackhawks fan, so we would always talk about the rivalry between the Red Wings and and the Blackhawks. And sadly, Bob got into a very serious accident several years ago on the road that ruined his legs and his back, and sadly
he got really bad.
he was in pain for a long time, and sadly he took his own life a few years ago, which is very sad. But he was really a great musician, and just like you talking about recreating Ray Cooper's parts, what I always as a fan, and as I said, a very frequent concert goer to see you guys perform, what I always appreciated about Bob's playing was that he also paid tribute and homage to those original Dee Murray bass lines, but at the same time didn't copy them, and did add his own feel and his own artistry to it. And I think that's what you do as well, like you said, when you're trying to both emulate, but you also bring something of your own to some of the great Ray Cooper parts from the Elton John hits.
Yeah, Bob was a great well, he's an all-around great musician, a writer, a bass player. He played saxophone. He sang like a bird. Not many people knew how good Bob could. His background vocals were impeccable. He had almost perfect pitch. So he could sing so nicely, and great, you know, harmony singer, and just really aware of everything musically that needed to be done, or, you know, if you were slacking off on something, he'd go, hey, man, let's work on that part a little bit. But I knew him for a long time, and we played in a lot of bands together. He was in my original band that I put together in the 80s when I came to L.A., so that's kind of where I met him. He was a big part of my original band that lasted a couple years, and then called the Stick Men. And so I knew Bob, and, you know, on and off, you know, we did many gigs. And then, of course, then he got the Elton gig, which I think he met Guy Babylon. Guy and Davey were putting in a band together called War Pipes.
Yeah, War Pipes. And Nigel was in that band as well.
Yeah, Nigel was in that band and not playing with Elton. It was so kind of weird.
Yeah, it was very strange. They've always had a very interesting relationship through the years. Yeah. It's always been, even when he and Dee Murray were shockingly fired right at the pinnacle of the Elton John experience and the Elton John band, really, with Captain Fantastic. But then, you know, two or three years later, about five. Clive Franks brought Nigel back to play drums on Little Genie.
Yeah.
Which, right. out of nowhere, you know, and suddenly he was kind of welcomed in, and then suddenly Nigel was back with Elton. So it's always been a very interesting relationship between those two. But so you said you knew Bob and War Pipes, and...
Yeah, so Bob got in that band with War Pipes, which is where he met Davey, and then, and Bob and I were very close, so I would, you know, I mean, great. And then next thing I know, Bob's in Elton's band, and I go and see them play. Davey, I'm backstage, and Bob introduces me to Davey, and then, you know, a year or so went by, and Bob and I were over at his little studio working on some music, and Davey came over to play guitar for us, or I'm not sure why he came over, honestly. He came over, and he listened to what we were doing. Actually, I wasn't there. He came over to listen to music, and Bob said, he goes, who's that guy singing? Because I was singing and playing drums on this track we did. And he goes, oh, that's John. You know, you met him at the show, you know, last year or something. And he goes, oh, cool. And next thing I know, Davey calls me like a month later out of the blue and says, I want you to sing on these couple tunes that Guy and I are working on. So I go, great. So I go over and do this recording session at Guy's studio. And then a couple months go by. And next thing I know, Davey calls me again and says, hey, man, you know, we want to put someone in the band that's, you know, can sing and can play percussion and play drums if they need to, and do sampling. And I go, well, you know, I'm kind of the guy.
Yeah, right.
And I think he was auditioning another guitar player, singer at the time, and maybe another couple singers or something like that. I'm not really sure. But there were a couple other guys in the mix, and it wound up being me and Billy Trudell that he put in. So that's funny, because we did these rehearsals in the south of France. Was the first time I met Elton. And you talk about when I was comfortable being in the band, right?
Right.
The first time I met Elton, we're in the south of France rehearsing for this, my one show that I was going to do in Germany. And after that, I didn't know if I was part of the band.
Right.
I mean, Davey said, well, I guess you're in the, you know, this, great, I'm going to, you know, you're in the band. I guess you're all good if Elton likes you. I've never met the guy. I got to fly all the way to France, right?
I hope they picked up your ticket at least. Did they pick up your ticket?
We were doing these rehearsals, and he, you know, he was really nice. He'd come over and introduce himself and hi. And at that time, they had me set up right behind Elton.
Oh, because now you're on the other side of the stage.
Now I'm on the other side. But at that time, I was right behind there. So he's playing. He's looking at me and smiling. And we're playing, rehearsing, and everything's going good. And then, like, the second or third day, Bob comes over and goes, Dude, I think you pretty much got this gig here. wouldn't worry about it, you know.
Yeah.
I see, you know, he's like, I think he likes you. And years later, now, you just reminded me of this. Years later, we are doing the David Letterman show, right?
Uh-huh.
And we were promoting one of the records that came out. I forget which one it was, Captain and the Kid or something. And
yeah.
We're promoting this record. And at this time, there was plans being made to do the Million Dollar Piano show because we were finishing up the Red Piano.
Right, yeah.
And I'm in the green room. Bob and I are sitting in the green room of the David Letterman show just killing time. And Elton knocks on the door, and he comes in the room, and he looks at me, and he goes, I need to talk to you.
Oh.
And I'm like, oh, that's not something you want to hear.
Oh, no kidding. Ouch.
And Bob says, do you want me to leave? Uh-huh. And he says, no, I don't want you to leave. Just stay here. So Bob's like sitting there, and we're all three in there, very uncomfortable. And Elton goes, he goes, you know, we're playing the Million Dollar Piano show, right? And I go, yeah, yeah. And he goes, I want to bring Ray Cooper back. And I'm thinking to myself, am I getting fired?
Right.
I can see Bob getting a little agitated, like, are you firing my friend right here in front of us?
Right.
Like this? Is that how you're going to do it? And then Elton looks at me and he goes, but I just want to see if it's okay with you.
Oh.
I want to have both of you in the band.
Oh.
And I'm
like,
that was pretty heavy.
How cool is that, though? Wow, you must have been able to at least walk out with your chest out a little farther than it was before, though, right?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it was because we walked out of the room, and Bob goes, I'm a bitch, man. I thought he was going to fire you. And I said, so did I.
Yeah, given his past history.
Yeah.
So,
that was a good day. You know, I realized, okay, you know,
yeah.
If you think back on it, I thought then, well, you know, I think I'm pretty good.
Yeah, if he's allowing you to give Ray Cooper the blessing,
yeah, exactly.
Then wow. Yeah.
Yeah,
and plus it is important, clearly, for Elton to like you because you talk about Bob Birch. One of the funniest things I always, Bob Birch told me one time, I would always notice in concert that Bob used to have Bob would stand right behind Elton's piano right near him, and he would always be looking at Bob back and forth and smiling and playing a little piano lick and kind of saying, well, look at me, look what I just did.
Mm-hmm.
And still does that today with Matt Bessonette, the new bass player, although he isn't all that new anymore. But but Bob's shirt was always open. He always had several buttons open, almost to the point where it wasn't even open. Well, it wasn't even buttoned. And I asked him one time. I said, "Wow!" I said, "You know, what's with the shirt?" And he goes, "Well, Elton really likes my chest." And he goes, "I think that's the only reason I'm still in the band." He goes, I am never buttoning up that shirt. That shirt has kept me. Yeah, he said, that shirt has kept that my unbuttoned shirt has kept me in the band this long.
You never know.
Yeah.
But
so to that point, I mean, it sounds like it was an incredible whirlwind. But when you first got the call, like you said, now you are going here, you are in L.A. and you're going about your business and you're doing what you're doing. And suddenly this amazing phone call comes from out of the blue. And you're asked to go to France. How many days' notice was it?
Oh, I think I knew maybe about a month before I was going.
So did the full breadth of the opportunity that potentially at that point was there? I mean, you certainly didn't know, and there was no. You know, the way you're talking, there was no, you know, hey, if this works, then this and that. It was just kind of like, let's.
Right.
But did it hit you at that moment, like, this could be like me winning? Because, I mean, and I say this with all due respect, you won the lottery.
Yeah.
Did you feel like it was going to be a life-changing experience? Because that's what it's become.
Well, I felt like it could be a life-changing experience.
So you did feel that. You did feel that.
I had to quit the band that I was in at the time, and I didn't totally try to quit the band that I was in because I, you know, in the back of my mind, I'm always thinking, well, I've got the chance to do this one gig, but that doesn't mean I'm in the band, and it's not like there's a tour planned. And so I never really let myself accept the fact that I had hit the jackpot, that I'd won the lottery. I wouldn't let myself go there. It was like, okay, you're going to go do this gig. If he likes you, you know, maybe there'll be another gig down the road. But, you know, I would not let myself go there, which, you know, unfortunately, that's not the best thing for you psychologically. but I did know that this was a huge opportunity because it, you know, when I had to give the other band notice, it wasn't a great thing and they weren't happy about it.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah, because it was like they had to, you know, get a sub to, you know, to figure out, you know, to cover some other gigs, which, you know, all didn't work out. It wasn't a beautiful parting of the ways, but it was like, look, I cannot let this.
Yeah.
Oh, this is an opportunity that comes by once in a lifetime.
Sure. And, well, look at 20 years later.
Yeah. You know, and funny, because I did that first gig, and it's right after that first gig is when Gianni Versace was killed. And
right, 97, well, exactly.
Yeah, I thought, well, there you go. There goes your gig. You know, he's not going to play anymore because there was talk of that's it. He's going to pull himself up and get security. And
right.
You're never going to see the man in public again because there's a little bit of a fear there.
Certainly.
And then, you know, we did a couple gigs, and I thought, here we go. Great. And then what happens? Princess Diana gets killed.
Another month later.
And I'm like, oh, my God, you know, is this like an omen?
Yeah, right.
And the same thing then. He was so depressed after that that it was like he lost two of his greatest friends in the course of 6 months.
Yeah.
That, you know, the rumor was that he's not going to tour. He's done. You know,
well, I remember those concerts in 97. I do remember for a while there was a heightened security in the arena and even to get in. But even in the arena, I remember seeing security people at every opening, like, you know, to get into the bowl of the arena. There was a heightened security right after that happened.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But, you know, that's just. Yeah, you know, that's the strange world we live in.
So, what's interesting is that, and pretty much in 97, to your point, which is an interesting thing, even though there was talk, like you're saying, that he may just, you know, pull up the tent and not tour, that's really when that this current kind of 8 months on, 4 months off kind of, I mean, it's almost been a never-ending tour. I mean, there used to be a time where there would be an Elton John world tour that would run for about, you know, a year and a half, 18, 19 months, and then he would take a couple of years off, and then it would be a big deal, he'd come back again. But since you started in 97, this really has not stopped. People don't.
It has not stopped. We took 1 year, I think it was maybe 1999.
When he was doing the solo thing, yeah.
Yeah, and it was slow, and for me at least, you know. And once again, I thought, well, I guess I got to start finding another job. But Davey kept telling me, no, he's gonna, you know. Davey would talk to him, and Davey said, no, we're gonna work, you know, hang.
Yeah,
on.
Yeah.
And Davey didn't panic too much, but we all thought, you know, man, maybe this is not going to go as good as we thought.
Well, one more quick Bob Burt story. I remember hearing a story that Bob Burt said, "Hey, is he going to get back on tour? Because I just built a big pool. There's a big." There's a big hole in my yard, and I need to pay for it. Because it was a while since you guys. I mean, he did do that solo tour for almost a year, like you said. So there was a time when it wasn't, you know.
Yeah, yeah, but you're right. We have not really stopped since then, and you know, he's a workaholic, man. He's he is an obsessive. When he starts doing something, he just has to do it all the time, and that goes with every, you know, the way he works and the way he, okay, we're going to make a record, and it's all kind of like he can't sit still, and I think that's kind of the reason he's so great, and that's just what keeps him alive is this playing thing, because I think if he stopped, I think he'd go a little crazy.
So now, to your point then, you know, obviously there was the huge announcement about the farewell Yellow Brick Road and this this kind of ironic 3-year retirement, 300 show 3-year retirement. And he certainly has made it clear, even though a lot of people have sort of brushed it off, but he's not quitting. I don't think he can ever quit.
Yeah.
He'll probably,
no, I think so.
I would assume, given how much Vegas has been a nice deal for you as a musician and as a person, because it's a nice gig to just be able to go home to, you know, in quotes, at least to a hotel room without having to travel on buses and planes. So that residency, I would assume he's probably going to do a residency of some kind somewhere, if not back in Vegas, and play some show. He'll never be able to completely just say, I'm finished. So
he doesn't want to finish. What he's saying is we're not going to tour anymore.
Right, exactly.
I'm getting off the road, and that means, you know, and there's been rumor of doing residencies. I mean, obviously Vegas isn't a rumor. You know, Vegas, we're there, and I would not be surprised if we go back.
Right.
And so we sat on the plane and talked about, like, maybe playing the Beacon Theater in New York. And,
right.
Like the Allman Brothers did, right?
Right.
We'd go there for like a month.
Exactly, yeah.
There's other, you know, and London, there's places we could play in London where,
oh, certainly,
you know, where he could go home every night. And
yeah, I would think that is going to be the longer term, you know, hopefully, you know, health and other things moving forward. Because obviously this is going to be, I was going to ask you too, you know, you guys are finishing up the Vegas, the second residency here with the Million Dollar Piano, which started in 2011, is now ending in 2018, and the Red Piano started in 2004 and ended in 2009. So it's been a, you know, pretty much almost a 14-year kind of gig that you guys have done there.
Yeah.
And I'm just, but at the same time, when you look at the this tour that's coming up, it's, you know, it's going to start in September and go till at least 2021 is the plan. Are you physically and emotionally, I mean, do you have to really, because this, I mean, they're adding shows left and right to this thing.
I know.
Because there's such a demand. But you do have a break in May. There's a couple of shows, but there's really nothing planned between, I guess, at the end of June and then when you start in September. But are you physically and personally getting things, you know, prepared? Because this is going to be 3 years of almost nonstop.
Yeah, yeah, it's pretty, you know, you can say that, but what really... We pretty much go nonstop as it is, whether we are in Vegas or,
yeah.
You know, this upcoming tour, I think, has some breaks in it that are pretty consistent to what we've normally done. Like we take
right.
You know, the holiday, we take the Christmas holiday off, and
right.
Then, so I don't see it being that much crazier than what we already do, and the band now, we sort of base with Elton, so if he wants to base in London, that's fine, or he wants to base in L.A. or Atlanta or something,
right?
We can do that, and you know, so that we're not on a bus and schlepping our stuff in and out of a hotel every other night. And the good thing about some of these other cities is we're playing multiple dates.
Right,
so
yeah.
Chicago, for example, we'll go there and stay there for, you know,
right.
a couple of days. So that'll
be
really nice. So, yeah, it is. It's a little bit like I look at it and go, whoo, it's daunting. But, I mean, I just talked to Davey the other day on the phone, and we were just saying we're sort of not looking at the schedule because we don't
right.
know.
Oh, it's a scary, believe me, as someone who's looking at that schedule to pick shows to go to, it's daunting. That's what I'm saying. I'm looking at this from a fan standpoint and going, geez, I could only imagine, you know, from your standpoint.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's going to be, hey, it's life, man. There's going to be things you're going to, you know, Elton's probably going to get sick here and there.
Oh, as I say, yeah, that is so true. I said, I've talked, you know, a lot of people asking me, oh, how many shows are you going to go to, blah, blah, blah. And I said, I would imagine over a 2 or 3 year period, there's going to be a lot of cancellations.
Yeah.
There's going to be things, I mean, he's in fairly good health, but he's had some health issues. And I've, my gosh, I have personally seen a few things on stage over the last year or so, which were frightening. I saw one in Vegas where, and I think I even emailed you about it, where he clutched his back.
Oh yeah,
and was and yeah. I thought the show was over after the third song because he was bent over for a good 5 to 7 minutes, and then one of his assistants came and it looked like they were going to walk him off, and then he kind of just pushed him aside and really gutted it out and gave a great show. And I was close enough to see that he was in the pain seemed to have been going in and out. Because there were moments when he felt, it seemed like he was standing up and sitting up straight, and there's other times where you could see that he was very in pain, and he toughed it out. So, yeah, it's going to be a very interesting 3 years to see.
Well, he's such a consummate performer that he will not you know, if he can't sing, like let's say he gets a cold or something, his voice gets screwed up, he won't do a show if he can't. You know, he can suffer through playing the piano sometimes because it's real physical. But when he can't sing and really give the people what he thinks is the best performance he can give them, he won't do it. And I mean, I've seen him back out of a show sometimes where I could hear that his voice was bad. But I've heard many other singers so much worse, right, you know, yeah. I mean, like, so much worse, where they do the show and you're sitting there going, really?
Yeah.
But Elton, he won't do it, man. He will go, I'm canceling.
Wow,
know?
Yeah.
We go, all right, you know.
So
he respects that people come, he has a ton of respect for how much money people pay for tickets. He has a ton of respect for what people have to go through to get to the show. And, you know, you'll never hear him really say it. He'll say, thank you for doing this or thank you for doing that. But the fact that he will not give you a shitty performance is you know, the way of him saying, you know, this is how I respect my audience. You know, that's why he gives people crap that play the tracks.
Yeah, oh, definitely. Because and there's no question.
Yeah, he says, I'm not going to do that to my audience. They want to hear me. They don't want to hear a recording of me.
Well, people ask me why I've gone. I've been to, I think it's 174 shows now.
Wow.
Since I was 12, back in 1976, when my mom took me to the Chicago Stadium.
Wow.
And people say, why do you still go? I mean, because, as you know, I mean, the set list doesn't change all that much. The show doesn't change all that much over the last several years. And I said, you know what? I still get goosebumps.
Mm-hmm.
I got goosebumps when I was 12 years old, when he first came out, because at that point, you know, I mean, Elton John was someone I just saw on an album cover and in a magazine.
Yeah.
And suddenly there he was in person, and it was just a goosebump moment. And when the concert starts and he walks out and sits down, I still get that same exciting feeling to say, you know what, right now there is nowhere else I'd rather be than sitting right here. And so I go for the goosebumps until
for some people it's like chicken noodle soup, you know.
Yeah,
they've seen it so many times, but it's always comforting, and they get there and they just, you could just see them just sink down in their seats and go, here we go.
Yeah, that's how it is. That's how, I mean, it's a very, it's an interesting and difficult thing to explain to people who don't feel that or have that, but it is something that is clearly addictive.
We see people that are so that have come to so many shows, and I see people that you see are not, that don't go to so many shows, and they, there's not many artists left that can play one hit after another. We can play 40 hits, you know, ridiculous amount of hits. And you see these people, the look on their faces. I've seen people stand up. I mean, I'm so blessed to do this because, you know, I get to make people laugh and cry and happy, and, you know, you just to get to see them in their, they just go to another place. I've seen people, you know, cross their arms over their chest and they stand up and you can see them going, oh my God, he's playing Don't Let the Sun Go Down on Me. And then we play Rocket Man, and then we play Daniel, then we play, you know, Someone Save My Life, and I see these people, the same person, they almost drop down in their seat again where they just can't believe. It's just like you're hitting them one after another, and they're just like, they give up. They're like, oh my God, this is, it's so intense for them. And, you know, or tears streaming down their face, and because it touched a place in their, you know, some part of their life. And it's like you say, you go there and you still get goosebumps because it's just, there's not many people like this anymore that's going to give you.
No, that is true. And I'll tell you the one thing that's so interesting is when you're sitting at the concert, and as like I said, a longtime fan like me, you talk about hitting everybody with one major hit after another. And I've talked to Davey Johnstone about this too, who is the musical director and helps put the set list together with Elton.
Mm-hmm.
The irony is there's about 10 or 12 songs that you as a band have not performed in 15 or 20 years that other acts would be their encores.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, there are songs like Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds and Little Genie and I Don't Want to Go On with You Like That. These were top two, top number. Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds was number one for 3 weeks.
Yeah.
I mean, these are songs that another band would, if they didn't do, there would be a riot. And you guys don't even play those.
Yeah, and
that's how
we're trying to talk Elton into doing some of those songs.
Yeah, but I mean, just saying the depth of the catalog is amazing that even though you say, wow, I'm going to, especially that last, 20, 25 minutes when you guys really go into overdrive and you know, all the big hits are being played. And I'm sitting there going, yeah, and you know what? This could be five times more intense.
Yeah, it could be.
Because there are some other songs that people would go nuts about just as much. So to that point, real quick then, what is the song that you most enjoy playing, and what is maybe one of the songs in the catalog that you would hope to one day play with Elton on stage?
Wow. I guess, when I sort of grew up with the Madman Across the Water album, and mainly because I was just playing in bars in Ohio, and one of my friends had the Madman Across the Water songbook, this piano player friend.
Right.
And we would sit at this rickety old bar out in the country, and he would sit at this upright piano, and we'd sing these tunes, Leave On, Tiny Dancer. And so, Leave On, I guess, is one song I really love to play. I love to play Believe. I love those songs on that album.
And you guys have turned now Leave On live into an amazing jam. It's on, I mean, it comes out of nowhere, but it is really, I don't know how it feels on stage, but I got to tell you. From the audience standpoint, it's just amazing to watch you guys. I mean, you guys are really playing like a good old rock and roll band used to play.
Yeah, we are, right.
With good old jams and solos, and there's nothing wrong with a guitar solo and a piano solo and a drum solo, and it feels just it's got to be amazing up there doing it, because the power that's coming off that stage, you could feel it in your chest.
Yeah, that thing just has evolved. It's never like we sat down and went, let's do it like this.
Oh, really? Oh, okay.
Sometimes those things come out of mistakes, like Rocket Man, when we do that little thing in the middle.
Right.
Where Nigel stops playing, and well, that was almost like a mistake. Like Nigel said to me, he goes, I just stopped that one night. I stopped playing for some reason. He goes, I don't know why. He goes, just felt like I should stop right here. And so he just stopped playing, and then Elton went, I love that. And then next thing you know, the next night he tells Nigel, stop. He's kind of like telling him on stage.
Oh, how funny.
Playing. Yeah, so that evolved into that little piano sonata thing.
Yeah.
That was in the middle, and then we bring it back in with the little marching boom thing. And,
yeah.
And the same for Leave On. We went into that jam, but it never got stretched out like that. And then the same thing, Elton kind of told me, I want to break it down a little bit, get real quiet right here, and then we'll build it back up. And then it just turned into we bring it down, and Davey does a guitar solo, and then we smack it down, and Nigel, the same thing, Nigel, instead of just doing a fill and bringing us back in, Nigel started to do this weird thing on the snare drum, and I think he wasn't quite positive where Elton wanted him to come in, so he just kept doing it. The fill got longer and longer because I think Elton might have been shaking his head like, not yet. So next thing Nigel knows, he's in the middle, he's doing a drum solo. We're going, that's great.
You can see that everybody's having a good time. And Elton has certainly said over the last several years how he really loves the band, this band and this incarnation. And it, like you said, it doesn't have all the frills, and you've got a lot of people up there. As you said, Kim Ballard on the keyboards is versatile. Everybody is versatile, so they're playing a lot of different things. It's fun with you. You've always been able to step out from behind the percussion instruments and sing a little and go by Elton's piano and do a little fun little stuff with him, too. So that seems to have evolved kind of naturally as well, too, right?
Yeah, those are just things we just do it, at the spur of the moment, where I just get sick of standing up there. or Matt will go, come over by me and mess around.
Yeah, yeah.
Sometimes Elton likes it and sometimes he doesn't, because I think he's in control all the time. So he's like looking over his shoulder like, what's John going to do now?
Oh.
He's never sure what kind of trouble I'm going to get into. too. So
but it always looks fun, at least from the audience side. Well, John, I could talk to you for hours. You've got a lot of experience and stories, but I do appreciate you taking the time. And once again, congratulations on 20 plus years with the Elton John Band. It started as one gig and it's become a lifetime, and I could only imagine the life experiences, the travel around the world, the people you've met. It really has to just be, when you look back, I'm sure it's dawned on you now, since it's been over two decades, but you really are a piece of history.
That's weird, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you really are a piece of history, but I can only imagine the way this job, and I put that in quotes, has really just probably enriched your personal life in terms of experiences and things that you could have never dreamed of, places you've gone and things you've seen.
Yeah, exactly. Like, look at my passport, and people look at it and go, it looks like a book. It doesn't look like a,
yeah.
I mean, I don't know, 80 countries or something like that is a... Yeah, of course, I've never would have dreamed I'd go to some of these places. And some of these places I go and I have to ask the manager, have we been to Luxembourg before? And he'll go, yeah, you were there in, 2004 or something. And I'm like, wow, man, that's...
And even some of the venues.
Funny, and it's, yeah.
I mean, you've played the Roman Colosseum.
I know, that's crazy.
I mean, and you got out of there. You weren't slain, like many people. don't forget, a lot of the people that played the Colosseum didn't get out.
Yeah, they didn't get out, right? They were there. It was a one-stop show.
talk about one gig.
Exactly.
Tough audience.
Tough audience is right. That's funny.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time. And as I said, I've already got my tickets, so I will certainly be saying farewell to you over the next 3 years, and looking forward to the final shows in Vegas. I got to tell you, of all the incarnations of different shows, whether it's arena shows, whether it's stadium shows, residency shows, I have to tell you that my favorite has been the Million Dollar Piano show.
It's a great show. I'm kind of sad it's coming to an end, because it's so fun to do that show.
Yeah, it's for so many. I mean, from a fan standpoint, it's the intimacy of the venue. The sound is great. It's close. You can feel the music. You could see you guys. The set list is much more adventurous. And surprisingly, because I would have thought in Vegas you'd rather just play the hits, but to play some, obscure songs like you're mentioning from Madman, like Indian Sunset, is almost unheard of.
Exactly.
And so but at the same time, it's entertaining from beginning to end. And so I am sad to see that go away. Now, do you have any ideas? Elton has thrown just a few little hints about the production, but what do you have any idea of what this farewell tour is going to mean in terms of the production values, the staging, the set list, or has none of that really even been discussed yet?
Well, they're discussing it, but they're keeping it really under wraps. It's going to have something to do with Yellow Brick Road, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's going to be a huge part of the way it looks.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So there's going to be something to do with that album cover. There's going to be a lot of video. I think the whole back of the stage will be a video screen.
Oh, wow.
And I think there's going to be I think it's going to be multi-level. More like what we did when we played with the Billy Joel stuff, we were up on different levels. We were on little pods or something.
Right.
I've seen some really drawings where they're trying to figure out where the piano is going to be. But at this point, we won't know any of that until we go to our rehearsals, on the East Coast. And I think it's late August or early September. We'll have production rehearsals there. Yeah.
Well, I have noticed just when you go online to look for the tickets, the stage, the configuration of where the stage is and the seats, even that looks different. It's not a block. You know what I mean? It's not a block. It's rounded, and so it clearly looks like it's going to be fairly elaborate. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm really interested to see what it's going to be like, and I think that the songs that we're going to play are we're trying to throw in a couple extra little surprises, but unfortunately, it's like we talked about before, there's only so much time.
Right.
There's so many songs, and we have to keep it to a certain amount of time, and it's just, God, everybody wishes we could play every possible. You know, I was talking to Davey about trying to get Elton to play Come Down in Time.
Oh.
And maybe do a medley of that and The Greatest Discovery or something.
Oh,
like
how
that.
Great. Well, how beautiful would
but,
that be?
You know, it's like that comes down to that thing of, well, we have to do this song, we have to do this song. So, but Davey said he's going to, you know, try to push some of these other little songs that people just absolutely love that are short and sweet, you know.
Well, I vote for Harmony because Harmony fills the bill there.
Yeah, Harmony.
It's not even 3 minutes long, and sadly, that song, if it was released as a single, and it should have been, that would be a song he would have to. That would have been one of his greatest hits of all time.
Yeah,
if more people had heard that.
I think Harmony is in the running for the set list.
Oh, very good then.
I think it's Harmony or it's Curtains.
Oh wow! Well, that's great too. From Captain Fantastic.
It's something like that. It's one of those songs. I'm at the top of my head because it's funny. We just have this little. Elton wrote out the set list by hand and then had us come down to this dressing room, and we just looked at it and we talked about it briefly. But until you get in production rehearsals, and some of the songs are going to have videos specifically for that song, sort of like more like The Red Piano.
Oh, I see. Yeah, yeah.
Or like David...
LaChapelle, yeah.
David LaChapelle, more like that, and I think he might even be involved. Don't quote me on that, but
well, he was. He is doing a lot. He did the photography for the announcement. So he is involved in the design because Elton has said it's going to be his most elaborate production. So I would assume that would probably fall somewhere.
I think it's going to be pretty, visually beautiful.
Yeah,
and I also think that the. The whole management company, they're kind of shocked at how fast the tickets sold. I talked to some of them, and they're like, yeah, we really did not expect it. They expected this to be big and great, but they didn't expect the tickets just to really go off the, you know, be
well,
gone
but to your
so
point,
quickly.
But to your point earlier, there are not many performers left like this, and I'm not trying to say anything bad about new performers coming up or whatever, and you know, sound like you're 100 years old, but there is, you cannot deny that people like Elton John and Paul McCartney and Bruce Springsteen and The Who and obviously the Rolling Stones and some of these legendary people that are still around, that are still performing and are still selling out within seconds. The way I equate it is that, you know, the 60s and 70s was almost like the Renaissance in Italy with Michelangelo and Da Vinci. It was a very special time when there was this creative force.
Yeah.
And I'm not putting down today's music because after Da Vinci and Michelangelo were gone, there were still artists and sculptors, and they were popular and they were good, but they weren't like that.
They weren't like that. Yeah.
And that's the way I equate it here, and everybody always thinks that their time is great, and I understand that too. But when you see that, for instance, Lollapalooza takes 180 bands to attract the same amount of people that the Rolling Stones can do on their own in two nights.
Mm-hmm.
That tells you something.
Exactly right. Yeah, it's going to be good. I'm looking forward to it.
So. Yeah, well, we are too. And as I said, you have certainly passed the audition.
Thank you very much, sir.
And please know that you're what you are doing. It might not be as loud as a guitar or as a main drum kit or as Elton's piano, but the contributions that you give on the stage, your performance, and those sounds that you are making, people are hearing them and they are appreciating them, and they do really help to make those great music and those great songs come alive. So we thank you for your service.
Thank you. Yeah, I just did an interview with Drum Magazine, DRUM.
Oh, yes, I did. I saw that online, yeah.
In the March, yeah, I think it's in the March edition. And I'm also on an educational video for this Jules Follett, Follett. So I looked that up. I'm not exactly sure where that, I'm not exactly sure of the URL, but I will try to find it and let you know. It's a video series, an educational video series.
Oh, cool.
I'd have to dig into my email here and see if I have the website. Let me see if I find it really quick here. But It's a lot of musicians did these little interviews, and Davey did one too, actually.
Oh, cool.
It's called The Sessions. And it's sort of for educational thing for kids, but it's pretty cool. So it's called The Sessions Artist Series, and it's going to be, it'll be a YouTube thing.
Oh, very cool. Well, excellent. And you've also got that regular gig of yours.
Yes, I got the regular gig, yeah.
Take some time.
Yeah. Yeah, coming up soon.
And do you think that if and when he does call it quits, that you will continue to... do some things on your own, or would you it up? Yeah.
Oh no, I think I'll still be playing and probably put a little band together. And yeah, I mean, I don't think I'll be ready to hang up the old drumsticks yet, but we'll just see what happens, how long this tour goes, and I don't think he's going to hang it up.
No,
you said, we'll do this farewell tour, and. And if he wants to keep going, we'll keep going. But I see us just, working off into the sunset, man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, like I said, there will be many people that will be walking in the sunset with you. As I said, there's a loyal. One of the coolest things for me, being a fan so much and for so long, is I went to Grand Forks, North Dakota, to see you guys play.
Wow.
And I was in the lobby, and someone said, "Jim." And I was like, why do I know anybody in Grand Forks? And so that has been a fun part of it, too. I've met so many people. And so there is a caravan out there of folks.
Oh, yeah, there's a caravan.
Who travel. And as I said, most concerts that I go to, as whether it's in New York or some, out-of-the-way places like there, and I always run into somebody that I know or that knows of me, and we talk. And so it's really been a very cool communal situation, and in the few times that I got a chance to spend time with you and some of the guys in the band, you guys have always been really nice and open and welcoming, and it's very cool.
Great. So that's great. We try.
Well, very good. I once again appreciate your time, appreciate your talent. Thank you for sharing your both
you.
With us, and we will see you on the road.
All right, buddy. Thanks for having me, man.
Take care.
You too. Bye bye.
Bye bye. And so, that wraps up episode 105 with a fun interview with John Mahan of Elton John's band, touring band, and I will be seeing them many, many times over the next 3 years or so. So thank you to John Mahan for taking some time. I'm Elton Jim Toronto. This has been Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. I am here on business. I'm only here for fun. This is the only podcast from the end of the web to your screen.